Welcome to the Dinner Party Download. This is your icebreaker.
I'm not big on jokes, but I guess my favorite joke is the old Monty Python joke, which I think was like the deadliest joke in the world, which was two peanuts were walking down the Strasse, and one of them was assaulted.
I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano, and from APM, American Public Media, this is the Dinner Party Download, the culture show that helps you win your dinner party.
You just got a joke from none other than Anderson Cooper.
Yes.
That'll break the ice. And what better way to kick off this, our annual all-food show, than with one of the corniest food jokes ever.
It's perfect.
Yes. Later you'll hear from vaunted chef Roy Choi and vaunted eater, comedian Jim Gaffigan.
Yes.
Plus, music to dine by, courtesy of soul sensation Fantastic Negrito, and the inside scoop on tasty foods from knishes to soup jumu.
Yes, those are just two of the many excellent dishes you may have heard me and Brendan sample this year. Alas, we can't fit all of them into one episode, so here's a brief overview of what it sounded like.
Here we go, I'm going to take a bite.
Oh my goodness.
That is delicious.
Wow.
Should I be chewing on this at all?
It tastes like real corns going on in there.
Oh, it burns.
And Rico couldn't talk for weeks after that last one.
Yeah, that was me downing a shot of the bitter wormwood liqueur called Malort.
You should get hazard pay for that.
It was ill-advised. Luckily, I healed just in time for us to make some food-centric small talk. This is the part of the show where a journalist regales us with an under-the-radar news story. And back in June, we were joined by Vanity Fair film critic Richard Lawson, who told us about maybe the greatest food breakthrough ever.
Richard, what story are you going to be talking about this weekend?
I'm going to be talking about a healthier, tastier chocolate that some scientists kind of discovered by accident.
Oh, excellent.
Great. Mm-hmm. Scientists are working on the chocolate problem.
The happiest of accidents.
Hey, some of us do have a chocolate problem, Brendan. Let's not be
all right,
condescending.
Well, tell us what's happening in this veritable Manhattan Project for foodies.
So a brilliant scientist at Temple University, he was tasked with getting crude oil through pipelines more quickly. So had to do with the viscosity of the oil. So he figured out that if you pass it through electrical fields, it goes quicker or easier or something. And then someone at a chocolate company, I think it was Mars, they were said, can you try that with chocolate? Because it's been gunking up our machines.
Oh.
So he made it pass through this electrical field. It changes the kind of molecular makeup of the chocolate. And in doing so, removes some of the fat. So it goes through tubes better and it's better for you.
Wow. Well, better for you. But I mean, does it still taste good if you remove the fat?
Well, the LA Times, where I found this story, says that some of the research tried it and noted that it tasted better. So that's not really been scientifically proven.
But I'm going to cling to that with both hands. If you have a less fatty chocolate bar and it tastes better, then I think we're done here as humans.
Yeah, I mean, it's one of those things that sounds a little too good to be true. And like maybe like in, I don't know, 6 weeks after eating the chocolate, you know, you turn into like some Willy Wonka character or something. But for now, apparently there's 300 pounds of just sample chocolate lying around this lab at Temple. So if anyone wants to go to Philly and find out for themselves, there it is.
I'm on my way.
Wow.
Richard Lawson, thank you so much for the small talk.
Thank you, guys.
And now time for cocktails.
Shocktails. Once again, we tell you something that happened in history, then challenge a bartender to capture its essence in cocktail form.
It's like history is a turkey baster loaded with milliliter upon milliliter of glistening booze.
Never thought of using a baster.
First,
the history part. For this all-food episode, we're taking you back to 1847, when a great American put the finishing touch on one of the world's most popular snacks.
Michelle Philippi tells the tale.
The history of the donut is, yes, full of holes. Most folks agree they're derived from a fried delicacy from the Netherlands called an oliekoek, or oil cake. Then, at some point around 1800, Americans started calling them donuts, probably because they were made of dough and shaped kind of like a nut. But when did someone first poke a hole in that nut-shaped dough? Smithsonian Magazine credits Hanson Gregory, a sea captain from Maine who piloted a spice boat. Before he'd set sail, the story goes, his mom would pack him a nice bunch of donuts, flavored with the spices he carried in the ship's hold. Only problem? Mom's donuts were always uncooked in the middle. So one summer day in 1847, Captain Gregory grabbed a little round pepper tin and used it to punch holes in the treats, eliminating the uncooked center. Back on the mainland, he taught his mom this technique, then sent her ring-shaped donuts to pals in nearby towns. Voila! an iconic snack was born. Of course, there are variations on this tale, some less believable than others, like the one that claims Captain Gregory invented the hole out of necessity while piloting his ship through an ocean gale. Supposedly, to hold his donut in place, he jammed it over a spoke in the steering wheel. Whatever actually transpired, in the captain's hometown of Rockport, he's revered as a hero. A plaque there commemorates him as the godfather of the hole in the donut, though he never bothered patenting his creation. As he told a reporter in 1916, quote, "I don't suppose Peary could patent the North Pole, or Columbus patent America."
So that was the history. Now for the drink to serve with it. I'm on the line with Griffin Cooper. He is lead bartender at 40 Paper in Camden, Maine. That's along Maine's Rock Coast, where Captain Hanson Gregory hailed from. Griffin, you heard the history. What drink did that inspire you to create?
So the name of the drink is the Mortal Eyes, and I got that name from a quote from our beloved captain in an interview that he gave. And he said, "I cut into that donut the first hole ever seen by mortal eyes."
It was a momentous occasion, I guess.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Trailblazer, so to speak. And I got to thinking about, the captain was an importer of spices. Their family was Dutch. Those things kind of led me to put together a drink that combines those ingredients.
So what are we starting with? I'm guessing that maybe you're going to use Genever, the Dutch gin.
That's right.
Uh-huh.
And also an equal amount of Laird's Applejack, which is an apple brandy.
Okay.
Laird's would have been probably the most readily available commercial spirit of the time.
Great. And it's also like apple, I feel, is like something you might find in a donut, maybe apple jelly or...
Absolutely. Sounds delicious.
Yeah, let's do it.
As a sweetener, we're going to use allspice dram.
So kind of Christmassy.
Yeah, we've got some nice warming spices.
This is not a tart drink, it sounds like.
Well, to add a little bit of acidity and some tartness, we're going to use lemon juice as well.
Okay. And does the thing have a garnish?
We are serving this up in a coupe glass with a cinnamon, nutmeg, and sugared rim.
Uh-huh. Like the rim becomes like a donut.
Exactly.
It sounds great, but I confess I'm a little disappointed. I thought, maybe instead of olives, you do like a spear of donut holes to go with this thing.
So the lab in the kitchen, what they're working on currently is we're trying to bake donuts around the coupe glass.
Oh my God.
So you can finish your drink and then just go to town.
I think we just made you a billionaire, man.
Whew. It's these ideas.
Griffin Cooper of 40 Paper on the Rock Coast of Maine, and I really hope for his sake that he's not successful perfecting that invention there.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure dough-wrapped glass isn't going to help you pass a health inspection.
Yes. Glass is my least favorite donut filling.
I don't like it.
Folks, you'll find that drink recipe at our website, along with many, many others. It's dinnerpartydownload.org.
And now the soundtrack in which a great musician DJs your dinner party.
And today our guest is Xavier DeFrepeles, better known by his stage name, Fantastic Negrito.
Yes.
He survived homelessness and a near-fatal car crash to create what he describes as, quote, "Black roots music for everyone with zero concern for pop anything."
His latest album is called The Last Days of Oakland. For this all-food episode, here he is with music to please the stomach.
There's only one Fantastic Negrito in the world, and today... he is here with you. So, ladies and gentlemen, people of the earth, this is my dinner party soundtrack. So, the first song is a classic, "So What?" by Miles Davis. I love eating the jazz. There's just something about it. It's deep and rich, and it's very, very good for the digestive system. Your organs are like a musical band. And when you've got the combination of good company, good music, and good food, oh, that band can play. Heart is just pumping. Stomach is just letting the juices break them down. Kidneys. Ba-ba-ba-ba-ba-ba. I've heard that song my entire life. Man, it's been places. It's shot heroin. It's failed. But then it recovered. It's kind of like a survivor, which is something I can relate to. I'm the 8th of 14 kids. It was a complete circus. I ran away when I was 12 and moved to Oakland, California from New England. I spent a couple years on the streets, and then when I was about 17, I decided that I'd be a musician. Well, I'm going to be predictable, but this one, going to have to go with John Coltrane, Blue Train. I mean, he has you at the first riff. That's it. And then the other horns come in and play the chorus notes. Coltrane. It's almost like someone else is speaking in the back. And he's very opinionated. But at the same time, he has the skill to blend in and not be disruptive. It's like a genius, but he can speak to you on a level that doesn't make you feel stupid. At my dinner party, you'll see children, older people, former street guys, a loud Caribbean gentleman that drinks. You'll see a professor from India. He's loud, too. And you'll see a French woman that's 94, and she can tell you all about the day that the Nazis came. I mean, you just learn from each other. There's so much to talk about. That's why I call the Bay Area the greatest tribe ever assembled. We are some edgy, eclectic, diverse people, sometimes with very different opinions, that can all get together. Song number three, I was like, well, if I just pick all jazz, people would think that's all I listen to. I picked Asara Masuga by Hamza al-Din, and in English it means childhood. And this song, it's so festive, simple, and primitive in a sense. And it feels like they would have played this 1,000 years ago at a dinner party. It sounds as old as humanity, and it still resonates to the present day. Hamza al-Din is a Nubian guitarist, plays the oud. The oud is like a pregnant guitar, like it's made out of a gourd or something. It reminds me of my dad. Well, I came from a conservative Muslim Orthodox home. My father had a restaurant growing up. He called it East African cuisine, but when I grew up, I found out that he would just take all these different ethnic foods, and this was back in the 70s, and sell them to white people from New England who didn't know any better. But it was a good restaurant. If I was going to play one of my own tracks at a dinner party, it would have to be about a bird.
There's a bird at my window. She watches it all. She sells what I'm doing. She's hoping I'll fall.
I think that I was going for healing on that song. After getting into a near-fatal accident that left me in a coma for 3 weeks. I quit music for 5 years, and I came back home to Oakland, California, and I wanted to start a family. I had a son, and he pointed me right back to music. He couldn't get to sleep one day, and I picked up the guitar, and I played a G major, and it was like, from God, this kid just freaked out in the most beautiful way. And I came up with the idea of Fantastic Negrito, and that's why I'm here now.
Nobody
dinner party soundtrack from Fantastic Negrito. His album The Last Days of Oakland is out now. And Brendan, you know, I kind of love the idea of my organs working together like a band.
I don't know. I think it depends on the band. You don't want your organs to play Megadeth or Motorhead or
something. You don't want your guts to headbang. A chamber quartet, perhaps.
There you go.
Anyway, people, we're going to take a quick break, but coming up, comedian and food fan Jim Gaffigan says even he won't put just anything on a burger.
When this all-food episode of the Dinner Party Download continues. Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano, and here's Nanochka Khan, showrunner of the hit sitcom Fresh Off the Boat, with a gut-busting mealtime memory from her Persian-American upbringing.
My dad loved to go through fast food drive-thrus, which, you know, you would love. You're 12 years old, everybody wants to go to McDonald's, of course. And sometimes, you know, after soccer practice or whatever, we'd have friends in the car. And my dad, he thought it was super funny to order normal and then throw like a Persian food item in there. So we'd pull up to the drive-thru and he would be like, yeah, can we get 2 quarter pounders with cheese, a Big Mac, 3 large fries, 2 Diet Cokes, a Sprite, and some Zulbia? And then there would be like this long pause and the voice would come through and be like, I'm sorry, sir, what? And he would repeat the whole order again. 2 quarter pounders with cheese, a Big Mac, 3 large fries, 2 Diet Cokes, a Sprite, and some Zulbia.
We got the whole order, but we don't have that last thing.
Oh, you don't have Zulbia, the Persian dessert, sort of like a honey?
No, we don't carry that at McDonald's.
Oh, okay. You know what? That's fine. I'll just have some duh.
We have apple pie.
No apple pie. Just duh.
What?
Duh, you know, the Persian drink with the yogurt and the mint.
So I'm sorry, sir. We don't carry that. This is McDonald's.
I mean, it would go on and on, and my brother and I would just be horrified. Our friends don't know what's happening, and my dad loving it.
Nanochka Khan, showrunner of TV's Fresh Off the Boat, one of our favorite food-centric moments of the year.
Yes.
And there are many more of those to come on this, our special post-Thanksgiving all-food show. Coming up, we sample some Haitian soup and we dine like kings alongside Marlon Brando.
Sort of.
Yeah.
But right now, we're going to stay on the subject of fast food. It's, of course, a huge part of American society. In fact, it's a $200 billion a year industry in the United States.
Which I may have contributed to in the form of an occasional filet-o-fish purchase.
Yes, which I know for you is a guilty pleasure.
I cop to it.
But fast food is a staple of many people's diets because often it's the only affordable food in a neighborhood and because, shock, it tastes good.
Don't pretend it doesn't, people. So recently, 2 world-renowned chefs, Roy Choi and Daniel Patterson, decided to fight fryer with fryer.
Well done.
By creating a chain that serves food which looks, costs, and tastes like fast food, but is made from wholesome ingredients.
That's right. It's called Local, spelled with a K. The first location opened in the LA neighborhood of Watts, and they plan to open more in other distressed areas. When I visited, I asked Roy how the place fits into the ongoing conversation about healthy food.
On one end, you have kind of a lecturing going on, like you need to eat healthy, you need to eat nutritious, don't eat that, that's bad, eat this. But then when they're saying don't eat that, that's bad, and they say eat this, the eat this is usually not that delicious. It's usually like kind of boring and nasty, and kids aren't feeling it.
I remember I talked to Alice Waters a couple years ago, and she was talking about if you give a kid an apple, it's kind of intimidating. It's just like this big round thing. It's impenetrable and it's not tasty. But if you chop it up, maybe you put some sugar on it, it actually makes it more enticing. It sounds like you see this as a similar challenge.
Definitely, and that's what Daniel and I do is we just try to make food. And by making delicious food or approachable food or food that is fun in your life, I feel like us being chefs answers the other part of that question. Because we would never cook the food knowing that we were kind of like not using good or fun or delicious ingredients. And so that part is not even a part of like our brain process. We would naturally just pick vegetables or fruits to make flavors. I think that part is in the bag.
There are some parameters you gave yourself, and that's affordability and nutrition to a certain extent, even though it's kind of in your DNA as a cook. What was the biggest challenge affordability-wise? What was the toughest thing to crack?
We do have these parameters, $2, $4, $6. We look at the price, and then we say, obviously, for $2 or $4, we can't serve a whole breast of chicken. But what if we ground that chicken up, mixed it with sprouting oats, seasoned that whole thing up, emulsified it, then spread it back down, and then froze it and cut it into shapes, put a slurry on it, and then fry it, which would look in our sandwich, which would look like an 8-ounce piece of chicken. But because it's mixed and emulsified, it's actually maybe only a 3 to 4 ounce piece of chicken mixed with grains and oats. And then, but then when you eat it, our science as a chef hopefully will translate where you don't notice the difference, but your body actually feels better.
So as I ordered with your assistance before I sat down with you, a burger, some chicken nugs, a sundae, and a carnitas foldy.
There it is. So if you look at that, all the stuff I've been saying, even if you don't believe anything I said, like if we just look at this, this is more powerful than my words. We wanted to do exactly like fast food. So you have the nuggets, which are chicken nuggets. But again, that's that force meat that I talked about.
I'm going to try. And what's the sausage?
The sauce is an herb green goddess sauce mixed with the buttermilk mayo and then hot sauce.
And so tasting it, I almost sense a little fennel, like a sweetness and other stuff. But also, it's just fried good. I get that just animal delight of biting into a fried chunk.
Yeah, yeah. And then, exactly. And the experience is just a nugget. So if you were a 16-year-old kid, you don't need to know that there are sprouting oats in there. And you don't need to know that that sauce has tarragon and chervil in it. You just need to know that that is bomb.
Chervil would be something I'd call my friend to make fun of.
Yeah, exactly. And you just need to know that it's bomb. And then after you eat it a couple times, you may ask, you know, what's in this sauce? So then if we say chervil, they may laugh, and then they may ask again, and then what's chervil? And then finally, then the bridge opens up.
So I'm going to look at this foldy, which, so this looks something like Taco Bell or something, maybe.
Yeah, I actually, when we were designing it, I was thinking of the Monster Taco at Jack in the Box. So that was kind of what we thought here. So this is different sprouting beans and grains mixed together, and this one has carnitas. So we take a whole pork shoulder, we cook it overnight with garlic, and then we make a salsa verde that we mix into it. And then that's filled and then griddled on each side, and then just served for $2.
I'm going to try it right now. It tastes like real corns going on in there.
For sure.
Talking about the grilling and stuff, I guess you also had to make this stuff that could be cooked fast and isn't too much work, right? Because you're going to you have lines and you have people coming in, and you have the promise of offering fast food.
We got to serve this food in 3 minutes, you know what I mean? Otherwise, people start to create in an environment where it's already tough enough to kind of change the way people are eating. If we don't deliver, we open up that door for skepticism. The way we've really thought about it is a lot of our early visions were like short order grill, Philly cheesesteak, you know, where it's just literally hot stone, a piece of hot metal. Flip it a couple times, you get it in your hand. In order to do that, we have to take 99% of the work and do it behind the scenes. So slow, like any chef's kitchen. Slow cooking, building of flavors, layering of flavors, and that is what gives us the opportunity on the front end to not have any like advanced level cooking going on. There's a lot of advanced preparation, but they don't have any salt and pepper, they don't have any knives or any cutting boards or anything like that that they have to do. All they have to do is literally take that foldy out, put it on a hot piece of metal, flip it, and then put it in a bag.
It's almost like a classic franchise. You're delivered these things with very simple instructions about how to do them.
Yep. I know I started this interview by saying we're chefs, but the infrastructure of local, we're trying to create as a fast food company. So imagine every step of the process being just like a Burger King or a McDonald's or a Taco Bell. Comes in the back door, they put it on their station. The one in the front kitchen literally presses a button or puts it on a thing. They put it in a bag and they go. The difference with us is the system is the same, but the food is real food.
Chef Roy Choi speaking to us earlier this year about his restaurant Local, and it really helps to see pictures of the dishes Roy was talking about, just to see how much it mirrors typical fast food. So you can feast your eyes on those at dinnerpartydownload.org.
All right, and folks, Every time a great restaurant like Roy's opens its doors, there is likely another one that's closing. So, so on this all-food episode of the show, we wanted to pay tribute to a dining destination that is no longer with us.
Yes, Tijor's Chicken served as a hub for Southern California's Haitian diaspora. It was presided over by the charismatic chef-owner Tijor Laguerre, a Haitian expat himself, and this year its run ended.
I had the good fortune of catching up with Tijor to try his signature soup jumeau, which is a soup with squash and macaroni that is traditionally eaten in Haiti on New Year's Day. And there's a really great reason for that. But before learning about the soup's history, I asked Tijor to give me a quick overview of Haitian cuisine.
Haitian, it's almost like a fusion. You have the French culture incorporated with the African culture. Haiti, of course, was occupied by the Spaniard, then the British. And that's what brings the quality, the texture that you see in Haitian cuisine.
All right. Let's talk about this soup. Right. Which is why we're here, New Year's soup.
Soup jumeau, a very meaningful thing for me, because my grandmother used to own a restaurant where she only served one item in the menu, squash soup, only on Sunday, and it will take her the entire week to make that preparation. She will boil the beef bone marrow like 2 to 3 days prior. In my case, my beef bone marrow has been boiling for the last 3 or 4 hours.
That's the base. It's like a bone marrow broth, I guess.
That is correct. And then the squash.
There is a great story behind this soup, is my understanding, as far as why it's consumed on New Year's in Haiti. Is that correct?
Definitely a great start, because squash soup was forbidden to consume by the slave.
Only slave owners could have it.
A slave owner, the master, mainly they were French. So when Haiti became independent, to celebrate that, we wanted to show to the white master, now we are independent, so we are going to consume the squash soup. And we choose January 1st to do that.
So there's a lot of history wrapped up in this soup, both personally and nationally for you. Let's go.
I'm going to show you in my kitchen how it's been prepared. Then you will have to taste it before you leave today.
All right, so here we are in the kitchen. We're in front of a stove. There is a huge, looks like steel pot of something delicious boiling and some pans full of stuff. What's happening?
Well, what's happening there is the beef bone marrow, and that's where you're going to come across the flavor that you're looking for. Now,
So this has been boiling for hours, it looks like.
Yeah, it's been boiled for hours. So now, as you could see, we have boxes of squash.
Yes, it's just pre-prepared squash.
Right. If I was in Haiti, I would probably go to the supermarket, to the open-air market, and buy the real squash. And it would be a more intense proposition to prepare that, okay?
So cutting up squash is kind of a hassle.
Right. Then you have to boil it, remove the seeds. It's a challenge.
God bless America. You can just open a box and there it is.
You can say that loud, right? Loudly, we could say that. So there you go. We're going to add the squash. Now, to really make a squash soup, celery, give it the flavor. We put potato in there. We dice them. We put taro root.
Taro roots in there?
Yes. And then parsley, carrots. Another thing, which is squash soup. Key lime, it's another essential ingredient.
Oh, you're going to put key lime in this?
Key lime juice. The ingredient that goes in everything in the Haitian recipe.
Really?
And if I go to your house, I see you cooking, and I didn't see any key lime or sour oranges.
I'm a fraud.
You're not real. You're not legit.
All right, so we've watched this thing boil down. It's now looking nice and rich and orange.
Two more ingredients that we're adding. That will be macaroni and cabbage.
So macaroni.
So you wonder where macaroni came from, right? Yes.
I'm assuming this is a European influence.
Definitely, because these were the thing. Remember, it was forbidden. It was something that the master could consume.
I was going to say, because so far this dish has a lot of vegetables, it has bones in it, nothing that I would think that somebody who was, you know, poor, for instance, wouldn't be able to get, but this is the symbol of what they couldn't have.
That is correct.
All right, so we have here a beautiful dish of soup, which has all the vegetables in the world in it. Here we go, I'm going to take a bite.
Oh, that's delicious. Is there cilantro in this?
Yes, I forgot cilantro.
I love it. So that also even gives it, you know, for me, I associate cilantro also with Latin America. So there's all sorts of continental
influences happening with this, all different continents.
Big time, big time, big time.
And I'm not the only one here eating this. Gary Perard is here. He's a friend of George's. You're going to demonstrate to me the traditional end of the soup meal?
Yes. Traditionally, what's done is there's usually a piece of bone in it, beef bone, and to suck out the marrow of the bone and the sauce that's still in the marrow is one of the critical things to do. And it's even in the chicest, you know, restaurants that you might be in, you see people just digging in, sucking on bones. A lady of some stature sucking on a bone. So,
all right, but you don't have any bone left in your bowl.
Yeah, well, we could also chew it to where there is nothing.
But I noticed George does have a bone left. So you're gonna do the honors.
You see it?
Classy.
It's classic.
That would be Jean-Marie Montfort-Hébert Georges Filaguerre, better known as T. George.
His restaurant, much better known.
Yes, his restaurant is no more, but you can still read his memoir. It's called No Man is an Island. It's about his journey from the Caribbean to L.A., cooking all the way.
Let's hope there's an audiobook, because what a voice.
Oh, my gosh.
And folks, we've got a few more courses coming your way in this All Food episode. Jim Gaffigan's got advice for sticky food situations. Inash on Knish. Oh, and Marlon Brando orders room service.
Don't miss it when the Dinner Party Download continues.
Welcome back to the Dinner Party Download, the arts and leisure section of public radio. I'm Brendan Francis Noonan.
I'm Rico Galliano, and we're in the midst of an audio smorgasbord we call our post-Thanksgiving all-food special. Coming up, Ileana Douglas takes us to a banquet fit for one of the kings of cinema, Marlon Brando.
Marty and I ordered the regular menu and Brando the Henry VIII menu.
Oh my, but first it's time for our weekly etiquette lesson.
Yes, each week you send in your questions about how to behave, and then we pose them to someone we decide to call an advice expert. And today we're going to give you a taste of some eating advice we got this summer from comedian Jim Gaffigan.
That's great.
Over the last 20 years, he's become one of America's most watched stand-up comics, thanks to self-deprecating observations about raising five kids with his wife and about his own love of food. In fact, just a couple years back, he published the best-selling book, Food, A Love Story.
Fittingly, the first question we posed to him came from a listener named Chris Stapps, who wrote, "What's the protocol around eating food you have served to kids? How many times do you have to offer it to them and have it rejected before you can claim it? Or should you claim it?" And Jim replied thusly.
Oh, that's an interesting scenario.
Yes.
Well, that's why most parents are fat, because, you know, it's like any adult that gives a meal to some kid who for some random reason doesn't eat it, you sit there and you feel like, well, maybe I should eat it. And also, kids eat essentially the equivalent of bar food. So the food that you would eat at 2 a.m.
chicken tenders
after you've been drinking for 6 hours is what kids will have for lunch.
Yeah.
And that's also, I mean, kids, they'll eat like one chicken tender, or they'll say like, I want pancakes and eggs, and there's an exhaustion, so you're like, all right, fine, just get the pancakes and eggs. And then they're just like drinking orange juice for breakfast. So you'll look at the pancakes and eggs, which if you're a responsible adult, you're like, I'm not going to eat both of these, but you end up eating both of them.
Yeah. Is it under the guise of, you know, we don't want this to go to waste, being a good example for your children about food waste, or is it just...
I think it's just food in front of you. And you know, as you get older, your metabolism stops, and there's something like when you're... Like when I was single and I, you know, I wouldn't have like pancakes in my apartment.
Yeah.
But when you have children... The food is in front of you, and you've paid for it.
But what's the advice here, then? Should we avoid doing that to ourselves, or it's just give up?
I think you're going to take the kids' food anyway.
Yeah,
unless they touched it, because children are filthy. Yeah, so it's... Yeah, I think just take the food.
All right, Chris Stapps.
Eat the food.
Good luck. Enjoy your new weight. Here's something from Confused and Messy in St. Paul. Confused and Messy writes, "How does one eat a burger in public that is taller than it is wide? Using a fork and knife seems like cheating."
Yeah, I think, well, first of all, I've done this many times, so I should. I think you got to cut it in half. That's what you got to do.
Oh.
First of all, it's you know, I hope if it's that tall that there's at least a fried egg on there so you've earned some of that height.
But it's not just bun or something?
Yeah, or Brussels sprouts, something weird on there. Yeah, you can have avocado. I'm all right with that. But, like, don't put pulled pork or on a burger. You know, don't take, like, an entire entree and put it on there.
Yeah.
Like, when they put pasta, you ever go into Zabarro's and they have, like, pasta on the pizza? Don't you want to just go, stop doing this, right?
Choose one.
Just stop, all right? I know we're trying to make some money, but, like, let's just not do that.
Yeah, novelty stops at a certain point.
Yeah. And so I think you cut it in half.
I guess the thing is, she asks, is using a knife, fork and knife seems cheating. My question maybe is a more ontological. It's like, is it still a burger if you're using a fork and knife? Because I think that's almost you're in steak frites territory.
Oh,
if you
my
can't...
gosh.
I think if it's got the bun, it's a burger.
Okay.
But I think that using a fork and knife, I mean, that's just wrong. I mean, didn't that kill, like, John Kasich campaign? You know, isn't that why he's not the Republican nominee?
I don't
No. But de Blasio, the mayor of New York, had trouble for using a fork and knife with pizza in New York.
Oh,
you're right. Just stay, if you're a politician, stay away from forks and knives.
So, but I do have to point out, to cut the thing in half, you are going to have to use a knife. So maybe just a knife,
not
a fork and a knife. Maybe the fork is the problem.
Yeah. Or just get a normal burger. Don't, you know.
Yeah.
Don't get an Empire State Building burger.
That's right.
That's my reference for tall.
All right. So, Enrico, just to clarify, if you're using the knife, you're still using your hand to carry the burger to your mouth.
Yeah. Okay. It has to be carried to the mouth with a hand.
Or
a mechanical hand. You know what I mean?
There's that.
I'm not against technology.
Some sort of crane.
Well, I'm sure Elon Musk is working on something, right? I mean, he's got to be like, now you don't even have to move your arm. Thanks, Elon Musk.
If he's not, he is now.
Yeah.
Jim Gaffigan. Thank you so much for telling our audience how to behave and eat.
Thanks, you guys.
Comedian Jim Gaffigan with a glimpse into our future. Mm-hmm. I guess forget Mars 2020. Instead, we're going to see a robot arm touch down on a sesame bun in the next 4 years.
It's dreams like this that drive innovation.
All right. But now on this All Food episode, we're going to jump from the future into the past to learn a little bit about what's kind of an age-old comfort food in my hometown of New York City. I'm speaking, of course, about knish.
Yes, these would be the doughy snacks with potato and stuff inside.
Mm-hmm.
Of course.
They're essentially little pockets of warm carbo goodness that come from Jewish tradition.
That's right. If you eat enough of them, you can just forego shopping for winter clothes and build up a nice layer of knish instead.
That's right. We call that grandma's knish sweater.
Do we?
Anyway, well, we should. Anyway, last year I met with Laura Silver, author of a book about knish, at a food stand called Knish Knosh in Central Park.
Nice.
And before I started digging in, I asked her to describe these little bites of Jewish soul food.
Imagine a lovingly wrapped hunk of onion spice potatoes in this cradle of a thin dough that's very friendly, portable, and usually not too expensive.
It's one of these kind of peasant kind of foods that fill the stomach quickly and cheaply.
Exactly. They fill the stomach and the gut in the bigger sense. I believe that sense of being full also rises up to the heart.
Yeah, you talk a lot in this book about the role of the knish in culture and to Jewish culture in particular. One story I enjoyed was a woman talking about her new daughter-in-law, and she was afraid that her daughter-in-law was going to make her son too snobby. And then tell what happened that made her feel like things are going to be okay.
Well, because she baked knishes, that was the barometer of her okayness.
She's like, no one who cooks a knish can be stuck up.
Exactly. If you cook a knish, you're a real person.
And the other thing about the knish is, practically speaking, it's to make a knish, it's not a delicate process. It's like you're really working the dough, you're making the potatoes, you're chopping onions. It's labor intensive.
Right. It takes time to make knishes.
Yeah.
And I think it takes love, too. It takes intention. You need some space. The tradition talked about making a tablecloth of dough. So imagine rolling a sheet of dough that wide and thin. Something thin enough you could read a newspaper through, or my book.
Nice plug.
I can help myself.
Sorry, your book is an exhaustive exploration of the knish. Where does it first show up?
Well, the knish first appears in literature in 1614 in a Polish poem that comes from a town in modern-day Ukraine. I'm not convinced that the knish was inherently Jewish back in 1614, because I found later instances of the knish being used for mourning rituals in the Christian and Catholic tradition. But I have identified a knish, a historic knish corridor, which extends from modern-day Lithuania down southward and a little bit to the east through Poland, Bialystok, Belarus, and parts of Ukraine. Now, you may be thinking that corresponds with the Pale of Settlement, where Jews were, and that's true. but this is a subsection.
Often on our show, we'll do a profile of like a new food item or like an old food item coming back, like a kolache in Texas, which is filled with meat, or which is kind of a cousin of this.
Knishing cousin. Kolache is a knishing cousin.
It's a knishing cousin. There's so many puns to be had here. But I feel like the knish hasn't really been part of this food renaissance.
Well, there is a guy in California who's making knishes in flavors like wasabi and white chocolate. He has a curried beef in there. He did a St. Patty's Day knish. So there's a lot of innovation to be had. But the knish, I think, is getting ready for its full-fledged renaissance.
You think it's right on the cusp of returning?
Exactly.
Can we say it's right on the knusp?
No.
You draw the line there?
A pun has to be, it has to be earned.
Okay. Okay, you're right. Okay. Let's taste the knish here. You have the kasha, I have the potato. They're beautiful. They're like big, big hockey pucks, overstuffed hockey pucks.
Exactly. They're like, it's like a stuffed animal. Not an animal, a stuffed vegetable.
We can't eat a stuffed animal.
No, but it has the coziness of a teddy bear.
It does. It does look kind of cozy.
This, what's so great about this is the dough is thin and you almost feel like you're eavesdrop. You're like a voyeur looking into the inside of it. And
that's true. It's like very sheer.
It's sheer.
It's kind of sexy now that we talk
right.
about it.
It's great. It's hefty yet sexy. Does it get better?
Well, let's give them a taste here. And it's very good. It feels like this would, if I eat one of these, I would feel fortified for the day.
Exactly. And this has such great onions. And you don't need a lot to feel good.
Talk about something directly right now. The knish, this is not health food. This is very heavy food.
Knish is not light. But you can have a cocktail knish.
When I saw cocktail knish in your book, I thought it was going to be like filled with booze, but it's actually like cocktail hot dogs.
Well, if anyone can create a knish filled with booze, it's the dinner party download.
A gin and tonic knish, that would be great.
Wow, it's like those little chocolate bottles with cognac inside. We could do the same with a knish.
When did you fall in love with the knish?
The knish was just something I took for granted till my favorite shop went out of business in 2005 or so. But I'd say the obsessive love affair began around then, because then it became a quest. Something I loved was endangered and gone, and I had to figure out what happened, and then suddenly I had to know everything about it. And I'd say the biggest discovery was the fact that my maternal grandmother was actually born in a Polish town called Knishin.
Destiny.
Exactly.
Knestiny.
No, there's a Yiddish word that corresponds called beshert. It's like, this is your fate. I was a direct descendant of the Knish.
Are there any knish puns you approve of?
Cano.
Laura Silver, her book is called Knish, In Search of the Jewish Soul Food. Also, keep your ears peeled for my new goth klezmer album, Knish Me, Knish Me, Knish Me.
Oh, you had to fit another in there.
I did.
You're like an addict.
Time to eavesdrop.
Actor Ileana Douglas starred in films like To Die For and Cape Fear, but she also talks about films in specials on Turner Classic Movies. Her book, I Blame Dennis Hopper, is half memoir, half love letter to the movies. Today on this All Food episode, we overhear her tell a tale of a dinner party we wish we'd attended.
Hi, my name is Ileana Douglas, and this is a story about me getting to meet one of my idols. Everybody asks you, who did you most want to meet in your life? And I say, oh, I met him. So I was doing a movie called Wedding Bell Blues, very low budget movie in LA. And I was in a relationship with Martin Scorsese, and he was coming out to Hollywood to win a humanitarian award, John Huston Award. I went to meet Marty at the Beverly Wilshire, and he surprised me by saying, guess who we're going to meet tomorrow? Marlon Brando's coming over for lunch. I just thought, no. Everything that I want to be as an actor is because of Marlon Brando. I had posters of him on my wall. We studied him in acting school. There's no way I can meet Marlon Brando. I can't meet him. Marty assured me, you'll be fine. And then we proceeded to go to this award show, and I brought my autograph book. Now, they were hustling Marty out of there after the awards, and in the hubbub, I left my precious book on the table. When I went back for it, it was gone, and I was devastated. It comes to the morning, I'm really incredibly nervous. And the door opens, and there's Marlon Brando. His eyes were this deep sapphire blue, a color I'd never seen before, which was arresting enough. But astonishingly, they matched the color of the blue velour sweatsuit that he was wearing. And I thought, Marlon Brando is wearing a blue velour sweatsuit? Who made that for him? Who owns that much velour? He said very quietly to Marty, "How do I look?" And Marty said, "You'd look fantastic, Marlon." Marty was always a better actor than I was. So he comes in. And that's when I heard Marlon Brando say, "Stop everything. Look at your feet." And we all looked down at my feet, which were inverted towards each other and kind of pigeon-toed. And he said, "That's a sign of insecurity. Why should you be insecure?" And suddenly, tears are streaming down my face. And Marty started to laugh, like, really nervously, like, "Oh, she's a very emotional kid." He kind of put his arm around me, like, you know, "Hey, pull yourself together," in front of Marlon Brando. And he said, "My dear girl, what is it?" And there was this rumbling inside of my core, and I couldn't stop myself. And I said, "I'm sorry, but this is really emotional for me. I mean, you're Marlon Brando, and everything I do or want to do or be is because of you. And I guess I am insecure." Suddenly, Brando's eyes were locked with mine, and he said, "My God, you're a tuning fork. Now I'm crying." And Marty comes running in with a Kleenex, and then now he starts to explain how I lost my autograph book and it was all his fault and he feels so bad. And now Marty starts to cry. And all of a sudden, you know, Brando says, "Let's order lunch up here." You know, I always like to say, Marty and I ordered the regular menu and Brando the Henry VIII menu because it was, you know, shrimp cocktail, pasta, steak, lots of wine, burgers, fries, ice cream, cookies, more wine. And it was a bacchanalian feast. And of course, the afternoon turned into night. We talked about his relationships with women and his island, of course, and another crazy scheme he had of collecting electricity from electric eels in his pool. I mean, we were under the spell. It was just an incredible lesson to be yourself and to be taught that by the world's greatest actor is something that I've never forgotten. So Marty goes back to New York, and I get a call from his assistant saying that Marlon Brando has asked for my address. I got back to my hotel, and there was the largest bushel of roses I'd ever seen in my life. There must have been over 100 roses from Marlon Brando, and an invitation to have lunch with him at his house. And of course, I was immediately going to do that because I thought, wow, this is going to be amazing. You know, I'll get to see these electric eels. But the assistant who worked for Marty said, "There's just no way you can do this. It means he wants to have sex with you." And of course, I was like, no. But that kind of got in my head. And I reluctantly turned down the invitation to go have lunch. That is my biggest show business regret. I'm sorry, Marlon Brando. I'm really sorry.
Ileana Douglas, that tale comes from her memoir, I Blame Dennis Hopper, and other stories from a life lived in and out of the movies. By the way, Ileana also gave us a little postscript about how and why she came to own Brando's Driftwood collection. Seriously, you should check it out at dinnerpartydownload.org.
And folks, that concludes this special all-food dinner party download bacchanal. Coming up next week, and speaking of food, straight-shooting chef, author, and globe-trotting gastronome Anthony Bourdain tells you how to behave, God help you. Don't miss it.
Till then, you can catch up on all our shows via podcast. It's easy to subscribe via iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, please leave a comment. It just takes a moment, and it really helps us out.
Thanks, as always, to the folks keeping our kitchen in order, senior producer Jackson Musker, associate digital producer Christina Lopez, and assistant producer Christian Coons. Our intern is Kathleen McGovern, Ben Tolliday engineered.
Enjoy your Thanksgiving leftovers, everyone, and bon appetit.